We've seen firsthand the consequences of regime change in Latin America, from Chile to Guatemala to Nicaragua to Jamaica, Haiti, Grenada.
The pounding of the war drum is deafening, and I don't think that the government and the corporations really want to be having the public listen to songs about peace and love.
You're asking inspectors to prove the negative. You're asking the Iraqis to prove something that cannot be proved.
As a result of what the Bush administration is doing, we are seeing an awakening conscience and consciousness in many, many people in America.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, January 17th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. It's being widely reported today that the UN weapons inspectors in Iraq found a cache of 12 empty chemical warheads that were not listed in Iraq's declaration to the UN. Although it involved only a small number of warheads, the finding appears to place Iraq in technical violation of the Security Council Resolution 1441. According to former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, the case containing the warheads was covered with dust and bird droppings. Peace Watch spoke with Ritter today to determine whether these findings signify a smoking gun.
A weapons cache implies that the Iraqis are, hiding something for later use. Weapons caches in Afghanistan where the Taliban and Al-Qaeda are pre-positioning stockpiles to be used. This, of course, is not what happened yesterday. That's not what was uncovered. I also am hesitant to use the label chemical weapons. What were found were 122-millimeter artillery rockets with unfilled warheads. Many times, artillery rockets like this, conventional, are shipped unfilled for safety reasons, and then later on can either be filled with white phosphorus, smoke, or high explosive, or in the case of Iraq, every reason to believe that they could have filled it with a chemical agent. I'm not minimizing the importance of this find. I think it's a tremendous success for the weapons inspectors, but to label this as a weapons cache of chemical warheads is misleading in the extreme.
Let me just say that is, I'm reading directly from the Washington Post
Correct.
Headlines.
But I'm also, putting my point of view on record here, mm-hmm. disagreeing with the Washington Post on this, or anybody else who would label, what occurred yesterday in that manner. What I would note is that, as I've always said, Iraq has an accounting problem here. In this case, it's an accounting problem associated with tens of thousands of unfilled munitions that Iraq acquired in the 1980s. What was found yesterday was a crate of 122-millimeter artillery rockets, unfilled, that was acquired by Iraq in 1986. My understanding, according to accounts, is that the crate was sealed, hadn't been opened since Iraq received this, and was covered with bird droppings and dirt. Iraq has said that, Iraq acknowledged buying this material. It's not as though Iraq was trying to hide its existence. It said, we bought these rockets in this quantity. What Iraq has been unable to do is to demonstrate how they can account for all of these rockets. They say that many of them were destroyed by inspectors. This is true. They say that many were destroyed by coalition bombing during the Gulf War. But how do we verify that? And so we have an accounting problem. And I think what happened yesterday is that the weapons inspectors stumbled upon a crate of these artillery rockets, which Iraq, frankly speaking, didn't know existed. And this is no excuse on the part of Iraq. I think Hans Blix has been saying that Iraq needs to be, more proactively cooperative. We shouldn't have weapons inspectors finding this material. We should have Iraq scouring the width and breadth of Iraq looking for similar crates, and then if they find that these are indeed accountable material, to turn them over to the inspectors. But this is not indicative of a hidden chemical weapons program.
I hear reports that Iraq must prove that they have destroyed all the weapons that they had, and also that in the past that they had tried to deny the existence of certain weapons and buried them and burnt them. If certain weapons had been destroyed, how can Iraq prove that they no longer have these weapons?
Well, that's the problem. First of all, the people that are saying that Iraq has to prove this are primarily Bush administration officials or people sympathetic to the case for war being presented by the Bush administration, where they say the onus for proof is on Iraq, not on the inspectors, not on the world. This is not a legal situation where Iraq is innocent until proven guilty. They say Iraq is already guilty, and Iraq must prove its innocence by demonstrating that it can account for everything. But as I know personally, in the 1990s, early 1990s, Iraq unilaterally destroyed many of its weapons and then declared this to the weapons inspectors. We were able to confirm that a great deal of weaponry had, in fact, been destroyed, accounted for. But because Iraq did not document this, we couldn't account for everything. Likewise, there are significant weapons that were destroyed by coalition bombing. Many of the 122-millimeter rockets which were found yesterday, but which had been filled by Iraq, were in the Qamishia chemical weapons depot that was blown up by coalition forces in March of 1991 without adequate accounting. So there is no way that Iraq will ever be able to provide the absolute level of assurance necessary to give them 100% finding of compliance. Then, you know, you're asking inspectors to prove the negative. You're asking the Iraqis to prove something that cannot be proved. This is why I've been arguing that instead of trying to account for every last, you know, empty munition, we focus on qualitative disarmament. Does Iraq have a factory capable of producing chemical agent? Does Iraq have factories capable of producing weapons that could be converted to chemical weaponry? Can the United Nations adequately monitor these factories? You know, these are the questions that need to be addressed. These are the fundamental questions and answers to which will enable the world to determine whether or not Iraq poses a threat to international peace and security in the form of weapons of mass destruction that warrants military action.
Mm.
You know, what happened yesterday, while it may be a tempest in a teapot or whatever, demonstrated that inspections do work and can work. You know, the Secretary of Defense and other senior Bush administration officials have denigrated the efficacy of inspections, saying there's no way that inspectors can ever find anything in Iraq. And I think yesterday they demonstrated that they are properly led, properly equipped, properly trained, and properly mandated to do an effective job. And therefore, it's worthwhile for all Americans to stand back and give them time to do their job.
Former U.N. Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter. Polls show recently that 20% of the American public opposes the war with Iraq, and activists with the group ANSWER, Act Now to Stop War and End Racism, are planning massive anti-war demonstrations in Washington, San Francisco, and dozens of cities across the nation and around the world this weekend. Here in the nation's capital, they held a press conference this afternoon to discuss their plans. Among the speakers was protest organizer Mara Verheyden-Hilliard.
Tomorrow, we're going to see the essence of grassroots democracy in the United States, which is people getting up, going outside, and taking to the street when they feel that the government is not responding to the will of the people, because then people must act for themselves. We're hearing from people all around the country who are getting on buses from 22 organizing centers, car caravans, flying, riding 17 hours, coming to a very cold city, knowing that they have to, because they have an obligation and a duty to stop George Bush from waging an illegal and criminal war.
Also at the press conference was the Reverend Graylin Hagler, pastor of the Plymouth Congregational Church in Washington, D.C. Hagler expressed the importance of the participation of religious leaders in Saturday's demonstrations.
When folk get religion, you know that they're going to shout. When folk get religion, they're not going to be quiet once they begin to understand what the truth is. So, sisters and brothers, we have religion about this issue, and we're going to stand up, and we're going to speak the truth to power. Nobody is going to sit us down, and nobody going to shut us up, and we're going to be shouting in one voice, even though we come from different religions, and we're going to be shouting the hallelujah chorus of peace right now in this time, and it's time to get the Bush off the lot. I mean, that's one thing that is very clear to us, not only at home, where people of color continue to suffer under the policies and the insensitivity of this administration, but also around the world, brothers and sisters being rounded up at the INS centers and right now going against into war against people of color in the world. The Arab communities, there is a war against Arabs and Muslims. I don't care what folks have to say. The reality speaks for itself. But the Hallelujah Chorus will be out tomorrow speaking justice and speaking about peace and speaking about where we need to bend and mold and shape and bring this country back around to a place where it can really stand on some moral ground. God bless you.
The Reverend Graylin Hagler, just a taste of what those who will attend the rally tomorrow will actually hear. Pacifica's coverage will begin at 11 a.m. through 4 p.m., and the West Coast will pick up the coverage at 4 p.m. As the Bush administration trumpets the need for regime change in Iraq, Latinos are mobilizing by the thousands in Washington to oppose the war. Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer for WPFW, the Pacifica station in Washington, D.C., has more.
We've seen firsthand the consequences of regime change in Latin America. From Chile to Guatemala to Nicaragua to Jamaica, Haiti, Grenada, nowhere have the ordinary people been better off as a result of U.S. intervention.
With these words, Chuck Kaufman from the Nicaragua Network commented on the call for U.S. intervention in Iraq for regime change last week. As answer, Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism called for the march and rally on Washington, D.C. tomorrow. So though we don't hear much about Latin America nowadays in the news, as all eyes seem turned to what ANSA representatives called the war here and abroad, the attack on Muslims and Arabs by the U.S. administration, we should expect a strong Latino contingency at tomorrow's demo west of the capital. Gabriel Rojo, a social worker in the D.C. Latino community and an immigrant from Uruguay, who's also a member of Latinos Immigrant Comigo por La Paz, detailed the extent of the Latinos organizing in D.C.
We've been collaborating with the Neighbors Consejo group in our efforts, and we're actually all going to convene in the same place, which is at the Lamont Park, Lamont and Mount Pleasant, at 10 o'clock this Saturday, the 18th. So we're all going to meet there. We're going to march around the community a little bit and then eventually end up at Columbia Heights Metro Station and take the subway downtown to 7th and Madison Avenue. And then from there, march with the large group to the Navy Yard. We're just trying to do a little peace and trying to mobilize people that a lot of Latinos are for peace and are against the war. I think that innocent people are obviously going to die. I don't see a reason to go to war in Iraq and kill innocent people. It's just really that simple.
Today, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., Macrina Cardines, a leader of the Mexico Solidarity Network, who for the last year has been fighting against the assault on civil rights by the INS and organizing the Latino immigrants, emphasized the parallel between U.S. interests in Iraq and Latin America.
Taking control of oil, not the restoration of democracy in the war against terrorism, is the real reason that the government of the United States is waging a war against Iraq. We oppose a war against Iraq not only because we support that Iraqi families who are losing their loved ones every day, but because we reject the threats that the United States imposes in other countries when they do not agree with their policies, such as in Venezuela or the economic blocks like in Cuba. We oppose a war because the budget that the Congress has approved to carry out a war against the people of Iraq comes from the taxes of American citizens and immigrants, and it is money that could go to jobs, education, and health care. The state of terror that the United States has created has also occurred within its own borders. In this country, that describes itself as the defender of the democracy, has detained and deported many immigrants, primarily from the countries of the Middle East, but also immigrants from Latin American countries. That is why tomorrow I will march in with the Latino groups, many people from the Central America, people who knows what the word means.
For Pacifica's Peace Watch, reporting from WPFW in Washington, D.C., I'm Reem Kathuda.
And thanks to Norberto Martinez, Tom Gomez, Ingrid Drait, and Matt Bradley from WBIX.org, Refugees and Exiles Radio Network, for that segment. Coalitions from around the country are mobilizing in the nation's capital this weekend. One event planned for this Sunday includes a march to the White House organized by the Iraq Peace Pledge. We spoke to Gordon Clark, National Coordinator for the Iraq Peace Pledge, about the march towards war and acts of civil disobedience and direct action planned for this weekend around the country.
The Iraq Pledge of Resistance is a campaign of nationally coordinated, nonviolent civil disobedience to oppose the war in Iraq. And this is nonviolent civil disobedience in the Gandhian and Kingian traditions.
Mm-hmm. Well, when do you intend to deliver this pledge of resistance to Congress?
Well, it has already started. It's nationally coordinated, but it's locally organized. And frankly, some groups started civil disobedience back in September before the congressional vote on Iraq, even though they didn't get too much media recognition. There were a number of actions on December 10th, which was International Human Rights Day, and there are going to be an even greater number of actions during Martin Luther King Days. In fact, some of them are happening already at places across the country.
Exactly what does the Pledge of Resistance say?
The Pledge of Resistance reads as such. If the United States sends combat troops, invades by proxy, bombs, or otherwise significantly escalates its intervention in Iraq, I pledge to join with others to engage in acts of nonviolent civil disobedience at U.S. federal facilities, congressional offices, military installations, and other appropriate places. I pledge to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience in order to prevent or halt the death and destruction such U.S. military action causes the people of Iraq. And then it's also followed by a list of nonviolent guidelines that people adopt when they're part of this campaign.
Mm. And so who has taken this pledge so far?
So far, it's about a little over 10,000 people nationwide, and groups are actively organizing nonviolent civil disobedience in 45 cities. That number grows on a weekly basis.
Hundreds of thousands of people are expected to converge in massive anti-war demonstrations this weekend in both Washington and San Francisco.
Uh-huh.
Can you talk about the actions that your organization, your group, is planning in front of the White House on Sunday?
Sure. Well, it's pretty straightforward, but for all of those people who are coming to town who would like to participate in nonviolent civil disobedience, and certainly for many people in the local area who are part of our planning organization, we will be holding a rally at Farragut Square in Washington, D.C., starting at 11:30 a.m. on Sunday, January 19th. So that's the day after the big rally. It's not conflicting with the big rally. Sunday, January 19th, 11:30 a.m. at Farragut Square. We're going to have a number of great speakers, including Liz McAllister, who I mentioned earlier, including Ruby Sales, who is a longtime civil rights leader, and she runs Spirit House over in Anacostia. And after a short program, including music, we are going to go to the White House, going to march to the White House, intending to commit civil disobedience in front of the White House on the sidewalk on Pennsylvania Avenue. And it's very hard to guess numbers, but at this point I'm thinking that it looks like we'll have more than 100 people who are going to be risking arrest, probably a much larger number of people in the crowd.
There have been some pretty creative forms of protest over the past several months as activists mobilize and identify ways in which to express their opposition to this war. We've seen people in Antarctica forming a giant peace sign in the snow just a few weeks ago. Members of a group called Unreasonable Women Bearing Witness took off their clothes and lay down on a California hillside recently to spell out the words, "No War."
Uh-huh.
A man in San Francisco has beamed anti-war messages into a highway overpass using his laptop computer. And we're hearing dozens of...
These are great. I didn't hear all these. I love these.
Well, I'm happy to be able to share.
Mm-hmm.
But why has your group chosen civil disobedience?
We've chosen civil disobedience because it is, at this point, the strongest opposition that we can offer. It's also one that has a fine tradition, a strong tradition in American history. And any of the important social change movements, labor movements, certainly women's suffrage, certainly the civil rights movement, have all contained significant parts of, and many people would argue have in times been led by, movements of nonviolent civil disobedience, which is both not only a way for people to express the highest level of opposition, but we believe a very strategic way to change the mind of the country, following on models like Dr. King, on the model of the Central America Pledge of Resistance, which was very strong in the 1980s and had a great effect on public policy and decision-making back then. I think that, you know, as a result of what the Bush administration is doing, you are seeing, we are seeing an awakening conscience and consciousness in many, many people in America. They suddenly see such an outrage, such an affront to law, to civility, to peace, to common sense, and the actions that the Bush administration is taking, culminating in this, you know, desire to wage war against Iraq, that people are standing up, people are making their voices heard. This campaign will not end if George Bush decides to start a war in Iraq. And while I can't tell you where exactly we'll go at that point, I can say that the spirit of resistance is strong. Mm. And I would say, by the way, for folks who are interested in seeing some of the places this is happening, they can go to our website, and that website is www.peacepledge, that's PEACEPLEDGE.org, and then /, and the word resist, R-E-S-I-S-T.
That was actually a comment made by the late Phil Berrigan regarding the fact that civil disobedience may be a dying form of protest. Not that it's not still a worthy form of protest.
With all due respect to Phil Berrigan, this may be the only time I'd ever disagree with him. I do not think that civil disobedience, nonviolent CD, is dying in this country.
Gordon Clark, National Coordinator for the Iraq Peace Pledge. A coalition of progressive black churches in Cleveland, Ohio, has formed recently to oppose the war on Iraq. The Intercommunity Interfaith Push for Peace, whose inaugural event held last Sunday, drew nearly 1,000 people, and they've chartered several buses to bring a delegation to this weekend's protest in Washington. Evan Davis was there and files this report.
When you talk about knowing each other, you have to first start with yourself. And when you start with yourself and you realize that you have been created in the best of molds and you have been given that label of human being, not only just for yourself, but for all of those who do not look like you, who may not remind you of yourself, but bearing witness and affirming the fact that we are all children of God, we are all human beings, and so therefore we must affirm and respect and acknowledge each and every one of ourselves as human beings on the planet Earth. But we also have to realize the context of what we are here tonight for. There is a specific context that speaks to the need for those who represent leadership, not only here tonight, but also in the city, in the state, in the county, all over this United States of America and the world, to go back to the original teachings of God when it talks about who is human being and what is the purpose for human beings on this planet. And so when we think about humanity in the context that we are here tonight, then we understand that somebody got the message wrong. In other words, as we say in the hood, you ain't feeling us. And so if you ain't feeling us, then we got to speak to you in the language that you understand. So as we get ready to go back in history, Halil Jones, we understand that as we sit here in Cedar on this street in a church called Antioch, that we can go back in our memory and we can reflect upon how long has it been and how long has the work been done and how much sacrifice has gone into the fact that we are still not acknowledged as human beings right here in America. When we think about history, and our brother so eloquently talked about the price and the cost, I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge and recognize the fact that as we sit and stand here today, that there were 50 million indigenous people who lived from Canada down to the Caribbean that you called Indians, but that wasn't their name, the voice of humanity. They weren't Indians. They weren't savages. They weren't red Sambos. They were Mohawk. They were Seminoles. They were Iroquois. They were Apache. They were Sioux. They were 50 million, and now they are less than a million, the voice of humanity. We must recognize. Now, we're talking about context now. There's a global thing, but we're going to deal with it right here in the house, in America. 50 million. And then we talk about the African Holocaust here in America. I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the fact that as we sit and stand here, we must recognize that over 100 million died from the west coast of Africa to the east coast of America. Who was that on that boat? Darkies, Negroes. Y'all know the other word. I ain't gonna use that one. Sambo. No. They were Mandinka. They were Nubian. They were Yoruba. They were Fulani. They were Ashanti. They were Akan. They were Malayan. They were Ghanaian. They were people who represented humanity, who belonged to tribes and nations of which many of us have no concept. I don't even know the tribe that I came from. You don't, many times we don't even understand how deep, do you understand what it means not to be able to go back and trace your roots to your tribe? It's just not a thing about lineage, it's about your root system, because your healing is in your root system. So there may be some cure for the disease that many of us have by finding out about our roots. The voice of humanity. And we know about Jim Crow, don't we? We know about segregation, Trent Lott, don't we? We know about racial profiling right now, today, yesterday, today, tomorrow, don't we? We understand that segregation, that Jim Crow, and all of these institutional things that you hear about and that you read about amount to two or three things that we all got an understanding. Oppression and injustice. Oppression and injustice. So when we talk about humanity and we understand that this process that we must begin to work to undo is a process of what we call dehumanization. Malcolm X said that if a man stands up and declares himself a man in America, that's one thing. But when a black man stands up, when a man from Africa stands up, when a man who knows who he is stands up and declares himself a man, do you understand that means war? What he was saying in essence is that for over 400 years here, when you hear the clergy stand up, when you heard the civil rights movement people stand up, when you heard the black activists stand up, when you heard the abolitionists stand up, when you heard all of those who fought against the slave, transatlantic slave trade stand up, that they were declaring war on what? Inhumanity. So we have dehumanization on one hand, and we have inhumanity on the other. And that creates the pathology of supremacist thought and elitism. And that's why we're here tonight, isn't it?
Khalid Al-Samad of the Council of Mosque of Cleveland. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.